And if you notice, we live in a time when it seems like that's kind of the atmosphere, so to speak. You're just about free to do whatever you think. And especially is that true in religious matters. It's not that way, of course, in the Scriptures. But now, you turn to Acts chapter 17. And you find out in you find out when Paul got to Athens that it was remarkable, you know, the religious climate at Athens. We're going to be looking at verse 16. Athens at this particular time was known throughout the known world as the highest possible place for education or the intellectuals and other things like that. There were a lot of known and important schools, and yet the entire city had this reputation. And Paul got to Athens, and one of the things that you find out in Athens when he gets there is that he's there all by himself. Finally, some of his companions catch up with him. And then he's moved to be bolder, and he gets actually to go to the place called, depends on your translation, either Mars Hill or the Areopagus, and deliver a speech. Now, this was a place where people gathered together. It was out in the center of town where all the activity, daily activities, actually took place. And more about that later on. But here you find in verse 16 of what, while he was waiting, it says at Athens, while he's waiting for the others, Timothy and Silas, his spirit was being provoked within him as he observed the city full of idols. I did some research on this, checking about the city of Athens, and not only was it full of idols, you know, that's really an understatement. It was a city that I would think the word ought to be, it was smothered by idols, or swamped, or engulfed with idols. Every place and everywhere was a temple to some god. If you went someplace and bought bread, there was a god for that store, and that consequently made that store a temple. And on and on and on this went. And when Paul was on the Areopagus, he could look out. He was up on a high place. He could look out at everything out before him on the lower parts. See all the people bustling around, all the activity. He could look above him and see the Parthenon and all the idolatry that was involved. When he got there, if anybody got there by ship, they put in at the harbor, and there was a long paved walkway, just practically a highway, up to where the city was at from the harbor. And as you passed by, there would be posts every so often. And at the top of those posts, there were leveled off places. And on the top of those leveled off places was an idol. And even as he would walk up the steps of the Areopagus, and they're still there to this day, those steps. As you walked up there, and when you got up to the top of this, where it was flattened off, where the people would gather, along the side of the walkway up to the top, and around the wall on the side, and this was all natural rock. There were places that were carved out every so often. And that was a place to put an idol. I mean, to say, well, was it full of idols? Yeah, it was full of idols. Swamped, engulfed with them. You couldn't cast your gaze in any direction and not see several. And we understand that there was one there that, you know, to cover all bases, I guess. that was to an unknown God, just in case we missed one. I don't know how they could have missed one, but just in case we did, we've got one over here. Now, Paul then, with all this, he says, I'm going to declare him to you. This is one that you really know nothing about. And I think of all, and Paul had several speeches that are recorded for us in the Scriptures. But his sermon on Mars Hill is his greatest by far. I've often thought to myself, what would I do in such a circumstance like this? I don't know where you would go today to find one that would match that. There'd be a lot of places that might be a challenge, but I don't know if there'd be any quite like this. And what would you do? What would you say? And you can read about that as we go along. But what I want to discuss now is the idea of really of idolatry in a city that was given to idolatry. You know, you can choose the god of your choice in Athens. You could. You actually could. There were so many. Kind of sounds like what we have today, doesn't it? You know what you have today? I can remember in a little town where I was raised, about 2,000 people, out the end of town one day, somehow or another, the city of Lagodi in Indiana was blessed finally to have a ministerial alliance. And one of the things that they did was rent a billboard for about 6 months. And on the billboard, they had the company that took care of the billboard paste the sign across it that said, worship at the church of your choice. Popular thought, isn't it? Isn't that kind of like worship the God of your choice? What would be the difference? Subtle difference, but it comes out to the same thing. It's all acceptable. That's the idea. And nothing is to be refused. Well, if that would work today about worshiping at the church of your choice, I don't know what was wrong with the extreme idolatry in Athens. In a certain way, it would be acceptable. But let's look at this. The first thing I want us to consider, and I think this is important. I think this is something that religious people miss. I think it's even something that members of the church miss. But it's right there in the Scriptures for us. And that is that an idol is nothing. Now, we live in a time where every god, whatever there is, and all those even back there in Athens, you know, what Paul had encountered, well, they'd all be, in people's minds, consequential, as though they were real and other things along that line. But I want to call your attention to a passage written by Paul, the man who experienced all this, in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. Now, Paul wrote this letter, for sure, after the events of Acts chapter 17. And in Acts chapter 8, verse 4, therefore, concerning the eating of things sacrificed to idols, we know that there is no such thing as an idol in the world, and that there is no God but one. What's he saying there? An idol is nothing. And I'm sure in his day, like there would be today, this is a part of meat that was sacrificed to idols. The meat would be sacrificed to the idols. Whatever was left over was sold in the marketplace. And people could go in there and buy that. Were they buying meat that was sacrificed to an idol? Well, essentially they were. And some people would get all bothered about that in one thing or another. And Paul goes into detail, tells them how to handle that. You can read the rest of it in chapter 8. But at the bottom line, that idol's really nothing. That's what he's saying. Now, he talks about it, and so I encourage you to read that. That's what it's talking about. That the first thing to understand before you get any further, an idol is nothing. 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 2. Let's take a look there. You know that when you were pagans, that's the Corinthians now, you were led astray to the mute, or the King James has, dumb idols, however you were led. I had to put this in there to accommodate a great number of folks that, you know, will use the King James Version on occasion. And Paul called them dumb idols there, but he didn't mean that they were stupid. Unfortunately, the word dumb in our day and age means stupid. But back whenever the Bible was written originally, and I think today, unfortunately, the word meant without voice. And it was later on that it came to mean something else. And so we've just about quit using that word in reference to someone who cannot speak. But really, it's showing that if they have no voice, mute or dumb, however the word is used, well, why don't they have a voice? Because there's nothing there to speak. That's why. I don't know if I have this. I got to look here. No. Wilbur Smith wrote this in a book titled Therefore Stand. As he, Paul, walked into this city, the first thing that smote his heart was the fact that here, in the world's center of learning, was the most foolish thing that men could ever create, and a vast multitude of them, dead gods that, having eyes, never saw, having mouths, never spoke, and having ears, never heard a prayer. Well, he's right. And that's keeping in line with the things that Paul saw and what Paul's remarks are about idols. Now, I might also add, this isn't just the idols of New Testament, the idols in the lower peninsula part of Greece. This would have even gone all the way back throughout all the Old Testament. It applied there as well. The folly of idols. Think about this. When have they ever done anything? You know, it seemed like that would be a natural question. If somebody rose to the defense of, they're really gods, Terry, you know. People really worship them. I know they do. Well, now if we're going to rise to a defense of this and investigate it, this seems like a question that's got to be in the mix somewhere. And I think it's an important question. I think that because we're looking at it right now, but I think it's important we need to look at it. When have they ever done anything? How about this? Let's go back to the Old Testament for just a minute. Probably a lot more mention of idolatry. Book of Isaiah. A lot more mention about idolatry in the Old Testament than there is in the New Testament. I think that's a safe statement to make. And Isaiah chapter 44 is what we're looking at. And we'll start with verse 14. This is one place where you find this. You find something like this similar in Jeremiah. We'll look at that in just a moment. Now, starting verse 14 down through verse 17, surely he cuts cedars for himself and takes a cypress or an oak and raises it for himself among the trees of the forest. He plants a fir and the rain makes it grow. Now, watch now. Then it becomes something for a man to burn. So he takes one of them and warms himself. Okay. He also makes a fire to bake bread. Fine. But he also, from that tree, makes a god and worships it. Yeah, that's what's happened. He makes it a graven image and falls down before it. That's true in the Old Testament, and that's what was going on as well. Now, there might be some made out of stone as well, or precious metals. I understand that, but now we're talking about this with the idea of it being made out of a tree. Half of it he burns in the fire. Over this half, he eats meat as he roasts the fire and is satisfied. And he warms himself and says, "Aha, I am warm, I have seen the fire." But the rest of it, he makes into a god, his graven image. He falls down before it and worships. He also prays to it and says, "Deliver me, for you are my God." And what have they done? Well, look at verse 18. Their eyes they cannot see, their heart. They've done nothing. Nothing. They can't do anything because it's not a god. It's a piece of wood. And there you have it. Do you remember the story, I'm sure many of us do, of the confrontation on Mount Carmel between Elijah and all of those prophets of Baal? Elijah's pretty well outnumbered. There was him and all of them. Impressive number. But do you remember how it all worked out? Well, we'll both build an altar and we'll call to our God to send fire down to burn up the sacrifice on the altar. And the prophets of Baal did that. And I mean to tell you, they went after that like nobody's business. And they cried out, "Old Baal, hear us." And no fire came. It even got to the point where they wanted to whip themselves up to a higher frenzy, so they cut themselves. And the blood gushed out. And in all of this, this demonstration of their zeal and how that raised them to another level, nothing happened. Why didn't Baal answer? Elijah even taunts him a little bit. What is he, a slave? Remember? He essentially says, well, maybe he's taking a trip, you know, somewhere. Maybe he's not home. How about this one? Maybe there's no Baal there. Now, we know what happened when Elijah built his. He built his altar same way. You know, out of wood. He used wood. He used stones. He did it the way the Israelites were supposed to build an altar. Certain way of doing this. The wood. Got the animal ready. And then he poured bucket after bucket of water. Had a trench around there. So much water. Soaked everything. Even water in the ditch. And he called on to God one time to send down fire. And fire came down from heaven. Burn up the animal on that sacrifice, on that altar. Burn up the wood. Burn up the stones and all the water. Pretty efficient display of God's power to produce fire. But now we see this. And why did God answer? Because God is there. You know, Jehovah God's there. But Baal, there's no Baal. No Baal. Now we move on to look at a couple other things here. An idol is something that is useless. I mentioned Jeremiah. I don't know, many of you might be familiar with Jeremiah chapter 10. If you turn over there, in Jeremiah chapter 10, starting here in verse 1, we'll read down through verse 5. Hear the word which the Lord speaks to you, O house of Israel. Thus says the Lord, do not learn the way of the nations. Do not be terrified by the signs of the heavens, although the nations are terrified by them. For the customs of the people are delusional, because it is wood cut from the forest, the work of the hands of a craftsman with a cutting tool. Now watch now. They decorate it with silver and with gold, and they fasten it with nails and with hammers so that it will not totter. Well, if you don't do something about this thing, it's going to fall over. It can't even stand on its own. Then it says, now this will differ in some translations. Some will have, it'll stand straight like a palm tree. I have no idea why it's translated that way. It really is, should be translated this way. Like a scarecrow in a cucumber field are they. Or a scarecrow in a melon patch, some translations have. We're all familiar with scarecrows, aren't we? I think we're familiar with those. They must be carried because they cannot walk. Do not fear them, for they cannot do harm, nor can they do any good. They're useless. They'll scare off birds. But you know, after a while, when the birds get used to them, the birds will go in there and they'll perch on a scarecrow. I've seen that happen. But now somebody's got to carry them around. Scarecrows in a cucumber field, you know. Scarecrows cannot move, they cannot speak, they cannot do anything. And it's because, now here we go now, they're not real. Well, we know that. They're not real. Yeah, Terry, they're not real. Despite what you see in the Wizard of Oz, they're not real. That's the point. But it's an idol. It's not real. Now, he goes on in verse 6. We're going to read that, verse 6 through 13. Because 6 through 13, after talking about these idols, then switches over to describe the power and might and action of the Lord. There's none like you, O Lord. You are great. Great is your name and might. Who would not fear you, O King of the nations? Indeed, it is your due. For among all the wise men of the nations, and in all their kingdoms, there is none like you. But they are altogether stupid and foolish, and in their discipline of delusion, their idol is wood. Beaten silver is brought from Tarshish, and gold from Ephesus. I guess that's the best place to get silver or gold. Doesn't matter where you get it from, if it's the best or the worst, it's not going to put any life or any action into those idols. They're all the work of skilled men. But the Lord is the true God, He is the living God and the everlasting King. At His wrath the earth quakes, and the nations cannot endure His indignation. Thus you shall say to them, the gods that did not make the heavens and the earth will perish from the earth and from under the heavens. It is He who made the earth by His power, who established the world by His wisdom, and by His understanding He stretched out the heavens. When He utters His voice, as opposed to Baal, there is a tumult of waters in the heavens, and He causes the clouds to ascend from the end of the earth. He makes lightning for the rain and brings out the wind from His storehouses. Or we might say He sends the snow on the just and the unjust, doesn't He? That's right. But you know, there we see the difference. And the Bible and nature itself shows us the great handiwork of God. But where is it with these other idols? Well, there isn't any. No God there. So, though an idol may be nothing, I hope we've seen enough to make that clear, that still doesn't mean that these things can't do much harm. You know, we don't just want to wave them off and say there's no God there, and so just forget about it, and it's got no consequence at all. Of course, they had consequence. That's the sad part of it. People gave credence and had faith and fell down and worshiped these things that were nothing. And therein is the problem. And so the real danger, if you're going to say that there's real danger about idolatry, it's not that these things are real. The problem is they present something, and what they present is a distraction. People are spending their time worshiping these gods that are no gods at all, and they're not worshiping the God of heaven. That's what the problem is. And a number of things can be distractions. We know what a distraction is. You know what a distraction is, don't you? A distraction is a person that's walking along, you know, someplace where there's some danger of falling. I don't know whether there's a hole nearby or a drop off over here or something like that. And the person's walking along there, and I don't know, he happens to see something. Maybe there's some kind of a bird or something up in a tree, an eagle or something, you know, that you very seldom see. And so here's the person walking along this path. Oh, look at that up there. Well, he's distracted by what he sees up there. He's not paying any attention to where he walks. And what happens? He goes over the edge or into the hole. Does harm to himself. Well, he's distracted. We know what that's like. You know, you're not paying attention, and you've lost your focus, and you don't have a clear vision of what you ought to be doing, where you ought to be going. Well, that's how it is with idolatry. Instead of having a clear vision, worshiping God, is distracted by whatever it is, and in a sense, that becomes idolatry. That's why it's said that covetousness in Colossians 3:5 is idolatry. Because a person gets distracted by these things that have caught their eye and they covet and they forget about God. But here's the thing about this. You know, man is going to worship something. I mean, you just talk to somebody who's an anthropologist, unless they're just a completely deluded individual who doesn't want to give any possible idea of credence to man worshiping at all. They'll tell you, yeah, that's right. They worship anything. Over in the Pacific Islands, there arose during World War II and afterwards what was called the cargo cults. The American forces went into these islands, and they needed bases in these islands. They needed a place where they could stop and fuel up.
long way, you know, from a base in Hawaii to the Philippines. So they needed something out there someplace. And so what they did, they would go to these remote islands and they would build an airstrip in there where the planes could land and refuel. And for repairs, if they needed something like that. Well, some of these islands, not all of them, but some of them were inhabited. And the natives were pretty well, you know, in awe of everything that they're seeing. And then planes start to land. And you can imagine what goes through someone's mind that has never seen anything like this before. But they gather around finally and they're watching this. And the planes land. And the next thing you know, they're taking all these things out of the planes. Now, they were clever enough to share some of the things in the plane with the natives to keep them friendly. And, you know, dispel fear. We're benevolent. We'll help you out. We're kind. We're nice. And so the natives naturally, you know, after a while, they would learn a little language back and forth. It would work both ways. Well, what is that that's in those planes? Are you ready? We call it cargo. Cargo. It was something that was delivered from the gods. After all, it flew in here out of the sky. You see how that works? And you know, whenever the war was over and the airplanes were all gone and the airstrip was finally in some places were abandoned, the natives had gone in there and they'd taken wood out of the forest and they'd broke it up and bound it and stretched it and bent it and everything else. And they had made replicas of airplanes, hoping that the gods would see those airplanes down there that they built and send more with that cargo. Now, man will worship something. Not just natives out here in some remote area. But people in the center of learning of the known world, like Athens, will do it too. So whether you've got an IQ of 50 or 500, I know nobody has got one of 500. You know my point. You get my point. Man's going to worship something, even if he worships himself. But if it's not the Lord, well, it's going to be something, and whatever it is, that's going to amount to an idol. In the American and the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, it's got this: if there is ever in the human mind a craving, now this is important, for visible forms to express religious conceptions. And this tendency does not disappear with the acceptance or even with the constant recognition of pure spiritual truths. And so some people need something physical to kind of fire them up. They need a statue of Jesus, or they need a statue of Mary, or they need a picture, or they need something along that line. Say, they need something physical in these matters. Now, we're never told that we need anything like that whatsoever, but that doesn't mean that some people don't see it that way. And so that works in there as well. Now, back to the New Testament in Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6, verse 24. No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth. Well, you can't serve God and an idol either. You can't serve God and anything else. You'll just the same token, you'll love the one and hate the other. Which will it be? This is also well documented in the Old Testament in a number of places that you just can't do that. Warnings are given along that line. I'm not going to go back to Deuteronomy, but there they are up there. Jot them down, read them for yourself. Warnings about this kind of thing. They're a distraction. You can't worship God and idols. And Israel, on occasion, we recognize this in the Old Testament, they thought to waver on this. And maybe sometimes, well, to kind of compromise things just a little bit. But then that was, of course, impossible. Now, the passage we're familiar with most of all out of Joshua, I would say, and by I say we, I mean man and mankind in general, is the passage there at the end of Joshua. There's a lot of other good verses in Joshua.
But Joshua chapter 24, it seems to me, is the one that most people know quite well. And it's in verse 15 about, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That's actually at the end of verse 15. Now, to get the first full idea, you need to read all of 14 and 15, where Joshua says, "Now, therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord." Did he mean they still had some of them with them? Or did he understand there was still a hankering for this kind of thing? Or that it was possible? Well, it could be any or all of those. But he's telling them, you know what? Now, right now, this time right here today, now is the time to make up your mind. Kind of like Elijah said, why do you go limping between two opinions about Baal and God and limping around, you know? If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord and these other idols, then choose for yourselves today whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served, which were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. Make up your mind. But he says, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Now the people go on to say, well, we're going to forsake these idols and all those gods, and we'll worship just the Lord. Well, yes, that's what they said, but saying something and doing something, we all know, are two different things. And they had problems and always plagued them as it went along. But you need to make a choice. Same thing over there in 1 Kings chapter 18, where there was the confrontation between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. Now, we've got to realize that an idol is that which draws one away from God. I mentioned that. And even in the New Testament, there's this idea of turning away from idols and turning to God, which implies that if you're worshiping an idol, you're not worshiping God. Get that out of your mind. It's not a compromise. It's not a dual thing that you can share time or something along that line. 1 Thessalonians chapter 1 and verse 9. For they themselves report about us what kind of reception we had with you and how you turned to God from idols to serve a living and true God. So you turned. You didn't split up your time. You turned to God from those idols or away from those idols. And you turned to a living and true God, as opposed to those idols which were neither living nor true. 1 Corinthians 10, again. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, we're familiar, I think, with the verse 13 about the temptation taking you and that kind of thing, which really you ought to read verse 12. And him who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. And then the temptation passage comes in there. No temptation has overtaken you, but such is common to man. God is faithful, will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, so that you may be able to endure it. Good passages. We think, well, that's what fits temptation. That's right. But you know, in verse 14, we have a therefore. The therefore is to tell you what these verses are there for. And so verse 14 is connected, actually, to verse 13 and 12. How are you going to fall? Is it idolatry? Because 14 says, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. Does that mean then that the temptation there in verse 13, is that connected with idolatry as well? Probably so. And where was this written? Well, it was written from Paul in Ephesus, probably, but to the church at Corinth. Over there in the Greek world, where idolatry was a real problem. Maybe it wasn't as bad in Corinth as it was in Athens, but it was still a problem all through the Greek culture. And so it's very, very possible that's what this is all about. Now, it doesn't mean that the passage of temptation, just throw that away and it can only be used for idolatry. It can only be used for everything, of course. But in particular, it's idolatry that's mentioned here. So, yeah, there's a distraction here. There's still a real danger. And then you stop and think about the folly of all this. It's something that's nothing. causing all this problem?
Well, I've got to hurry on. I want to caution. Well, I don't have the rest of it up there. Anyway, this won't take long. I had another point here before I got over there. Somehow or another, it's missing.
No doubt gremlins have got into the computer. Idolatry is not dead. It's not in our time. We have Hinduism that is a religion that is just shot full of polytheism. We've got all these things that are running around out there. Humanism is where you know you're persuaded in any number of ways that you are the higher being and essentially a call to worship oneself and the accomplishments of man and other things like that. And I think our Catholic friends, I mentioned Ligoti a minute ago, where I'm from, a town that was probably, when I was growing up, probably 70% Catholic, if not more. It's not that bad now, but it was then. And it was just hard to get away from it. But Catholicism has strongly denied charges of idolatry, and always has. But if it is an idolatry, what would be idolatry? They've got all their relics, they've got all their pictures, they've got all their statuary and things of that nature. You know, my uncle used to run around, he had the little thing on the dashboard, you know. He had his plastic Jesus up there. And things like this and everything that's connected with it. And, you know, I don't know what you do about it. They say, well, it's not idolatry. Well, what would be idolatry then? What would it take for it to be idolatry? And that's not really Jesus. And that's not really Mary. And there is no Saint Christopher. It's a statue or it's a medal. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 5, there's one God, one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. We've got a number of other things. We've got worldly distractions. Covetousness is idolatry, as we see in Colossians chapter 3 and verse 5. Well, let's sum it all up. Take your songbooks, turn to the song that's been selected, please. We do not have the alleged luxury of choosing the God of your choice. That's really the sum and total of what you saw in the bulletin there. There's only one God. He's not mute. He has spoken. He tells us today to listen to His Son, and He speaks to us today through His Son. And He has told us through Jesus what's expected of us. And Jesus has told us that we need to believe in Him as the Son of God, repent of our sins, and be baptized. So He's told us what to do. And His words are recorded for us. And here's the part of this. You know, when someone's words are recorded, they might be gone, but they still speak, don't they? Not too long ago, I was watching something on television, and it was a thing that was depicting the Gettysburg Address. Everybody's heard that. Do you have to memorize that when you were in school? Anybody have to do that? Boy, we did. I can remember. I don't remember all of it, but I remember we had to memorize it. Not even 200 words. And one of the greatest speeches ever given in this country. I thought about that. And I thought about a lot of them I've heard a lot longer than 200 words. Lincoln himself thought that day it was a failure. People wrote about it in the paper that, well, our president was expected to say something, and we expected a whole lot more than that. And after his death and a few years passed, it was resurrected and people realized how great it was. So I took an opportunity to read the final farewell address of George Washington. Boy, I'm telling you, that was a great speech. That's a speech that would never be uttered by a politician again. Any of them we've got living. Great speeches, aren't they? Lincoln still speaks and Washington still speaks. You know how? Through those words that are recorded. Jesus still speaks today. Not in some still small voice that you're going to hear outside or someplace or something like that. But it's right there through His Word. He's still speaking. And He says that if you believe and repent and you're baptized, you'll be saved. Have you done it? If you haven't done it,
Will you do it? Now's the time. Now's the right. This is the right place, the right time to do that. If you're subject to invitation, why don't you come? Well, together we stand and sing.